Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017 number 6. This is with Critical Condition, aka Robin. So, hello, Robin.
Hi there, Woz. How you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. So, why don't you introduce yourself and your channel to people so they know what we're talking about.
My name's Robin, and as you said, I have a channel called Critical Condition. I like to talk about different topics on my channel. I try not to pigeonhole myself too much, but the overarching themes of my channel is politics, philosophy, and self-awareness. I sort of was introduced to the YouTube community after my red pilling experience, sort of coming to terms with the fact that conservatism isn't so bad after all. My liberal education kind of had me quite biased towards conservative politics and people who would consider themselves conservatives. And so when I encountered Jordan Peterson, that all kind of came crashing down around me. And yeah, that's how I started off. And that's sort of still the topics that I like to talk about.
Right. But before we proceed, can you describe your accent to people?
So, yeah, it's a weird one. And I get questions about it all the time. I'm from Newfoundland. I'm from a very small town in Newfoundland. Newfoundland's an island on the east coast of Canada. And we have regional dialects in the province that would be, you know, specific to different areas. But its origin is Irish. Most of the people who populated are Newfoundland originally were Irish, and because it's a sort of a closed off island, the accent has kind of maintained itself. Now there is variation, and it's not a perfect Irish accent, but now I've been living in Ireland, I've been living in Dublin for the past 5 years, so it's kind of morphed into this weird hybrid where it depending on what I'm saying or what words I'm saying, I can sound Irish or just sort of weird Irish, I suppose.
Yeah, sometimes it does. Sometimes you sound American, sometimes Canadian, and sometimes Irish.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
It's quite strange. So when did you move to Ireland?
I moved to Ireland back in 2011, the end of 2011, right. Yes. Or 2012?
Right, okay,
yeah, a while ago.
Yeah, like five. That's quite a long time to for an accent to change. So okay. So you wanted to, let's talk about how you became red-pilled and the process of that, when it started. Obviously, well, actually, let's first talk about you say you came from a small town in Newfoundland.
Yeah,
so
sure.
What was the culture like there? How much of traditional Irish culture had it retained?
Quite a bit. It's a very small. I'm from a town called Grand Bank. It was a fishing community in its heyday, but since the sort of cod stocks became so depleted 80 years ago or so, there was a moratorium put on fishing, and so now the town really just survives on tourism. It's a really beautiful town in the middle of nowhere. There's about 2,000 people who live there. So it's very tiny. It's about a 5-hour drive away from the nearest, you know, strip mall or airport or anything like that. So it's very isolated. And I would have grown up singing Irish folk songs and being told folk stories that would be Irish in origin as a child. It's a very, Christianity and religion would be very, very common in my town. Like there's one functioning pub in my town, but there's 6 churches. So
that's not very Irish, to be honest.
Well, you could travel to the next town over and there would be a lot more pubs, which unfortunately would contribute to a lot of drink driving. But yeah. So the accent, I suppose, is still quite Irish, and the food that we would eat, you know, meat and 2 veg, kind of Irish, I suppose. But yeah, that's pretty much it.
Right, and I'm just thinking in reference to the red pill. What was the culture like in this town?
Well, I mean, amongst the youth, unfortunately, it's kind of a lot of drinking, a lot of drinking. I mean, my parents are teachers, and my grandparents would have been very involved in the church. So I had a very strict and traditional upbringing, which kind of alienated me from the rest of my peers in the town. But most people would like hunting, you know, winter activities, sport, would be really, really popular. You know, skidooing and mountain climbing and hiking and all of those things would be really, really popular. But drinking among the youth would be kind of an issue, to be honest. Now, it wasn't something that I dabbled in too often because, as I said, my parents were really strict. But not a lot of people cared about education either. There was kind of this culture of there's no point in trying because we're stuck here anyway, which is kind of depressing, really, growing up. I mean, from the time I was 14 or so, I had decided I was leaving. And so I worked really hard to get good grades so that I could apply to a university elsewhere. And so I did. And then went
to... So you wanted to explore...
Yes.
The world or Canada? Or
the world, the world. I mean, my father is actually from Texas. My father is an American. So my parents split up when I was quite young, and he moved back to America. And all throughout my childhood, my father continuously reminded me that there was a great big world out there worth exploring and worth seeing, you know. I think there's kind of this feeling in Outport, Newfoundland, where you can feel like you're in a bit of a bubble, you know, because nothing really goes in or comes out of the place, not very often anyways. So that influence from my father being from another place and constantly encouraging me to go see the big world was a major influence on me.
Right, I see. So where did you travel to Ireland immediately, or was that
No, so I went other places first. So when I traveled throughout Canada as a teenager because I was in Sea Cadets. Do you know what Sea Cadets is?
Not really,
it's
but
kind of nerdy. It's kind of nerdy. Like I was in a marching band. It's kind of like junior Navy. So you do like drill and you march around and salute. And there's all sorts of different activities like camping and canoeing and riflery and sailing that you do as a kid. And we go to camp in the summer. So each summer from 14 to 17, I would go to a different province for roughly 6 weeks, British Columbia, Nova Scotia, and Ontario. And that was my first time being outside of Newfoundland. And then once I graduated, I went to Ottawa, Ontario, the capital city of Canada, to go to university. And I was there for 5 years. And about 2 months...
What did you study?
I'm a bit embarrassed to say, but I have a liberal arts degree. So I studied film theory, so like critical theory, that kind of thing, and also communications. Mass communications was my minor. So lots of liberal propaganda.
Marxy Waxy.
Yeah, exactly. It's all behind me now.
Right. So, and then you ended up in Ireland. How did that happen?
So about two months after I finished my degree in Ottawa, my mother was contacted by a man who she worked with in my high school. So he was an English teacher. And when he retired, he wanted to continue teaching English. And so he went to South Korea to teach English and was there for years and years. And he was coming to his retirement in South Korea, and he was given the task of finding his replacement. And I don't really know why he thought of me. Maybe just random chance. I don't know. But he contacted my mom and said, you know, would Robin be interested in a teaching position in South Korea? I can set her up with an interview if she's interested. And so I just thought that was the most amazing opportunity because it's great pay. You make really good money over there. They pay for your flight over and back. There's no rent. And it was an opportunity to explore Asia and Asian culture, which is something that's always been of interest to me. So I said, absolutely. I got the interview. They gave me the job, and off to Korea I went after about three or four months after graduating. And so in Korea, I met an Irish guy who was also an English teacher. And we sort of started a relationship and have been together ever since.
Ah, I see. And then you went back to Ireland with him.
Exactly. So we were in Korea for about 13 months. Then we traveled through Southeast Asia for 5 months backpacking. And then after that, it was pretty hardcore. That was probably my first true red pill experience backpacking. I had never seen poverty like I had when I was traveling through places like Cambodia and through certain parts of India. And it was those experiences and confrontations with other cultures that made me understand and know what Canadian culture was by comparison. And so when I got back to Newfoundland, I just decided, you know, I still had itchy feet. I wanted to see the rest of the world, and Europe was too tempting not to take advantage of that opportunity. So I moved to Ireland straight after.
I see. And how old were you at that point?
I moved to Ireland when I was 24. Yeah, I'm 29 now, so 24.
Right, okay. And how did I mean, obviously, one would think you would recognize things in Ireland that you had known as a child in Newfoundland.
Absolutely. It really wasn't difficult for me to feel kind of at home in Irish culture. Like the sort of stereotypical Irish personality, you know, where you know there's lots of storytelling and lots of laughter and jokes and sarcasm and piss taking and but ultimately friendly, you know, and warm-hearted. All of those things would have been really familiar to me, and so it wasn't really a task to feel at home in Ireland at all.
Right. Were there things that made more sense in Ireland that you had experienced in Newfoundland? I'm just thinking about like an ancestral culture.
I'm not sure. Maybe, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that question, to be honest.
I'm sorry, it's quite a strange question to ask. I just wonder because obviously you grew up in a descendant of Irish culture and a
Yes.
sort of outpost of Ireland. That would be how it had started out. So I wonder, do you then encounter things in Ireland that, and realize, oh, this is how that started?
Well, I suppose with the drinking culture and the music, it seemed a little bit, I don't want to say positive might be the wrong word, but there was this element of, you know, the public house, being a meeting place where people could come to, you know, wash away their sorrows or, you know, be happy and chat with other people in the community. That wasn't really a part of the drinking culture back home, whereas, you know, back home it was really just about getting as drunk as possible as
Right,
fast as
that's exactly the kind of thing that I was thinking of. Because
yeah.
in obviously in Britain, the pub has been going for, I think it's 1,000 years that the first public house, that's when it started. It was like around 1,000 AD, and obviously then a culture develops around that
Yeah.
to handle the consequences of people drinking. But then if you transplant those people to a completely new place, they'll obviously retain some things, but then but not everything. So
Yeah,
then they're
no.
sort of operating in the darkness, as it were.
Absolutely. All of the like I do you know what Shannos singing is?
No, is that Irish
So
sea shanties?
it's so basically like if you're in the pub, every so often like an old lad will start singing just like randomly, quite loud in Gaelic. And as soon as that starts happening, out of respect, everyone puts their drink down and the pub goes completely silent and everyone is attentive and respectful and listens to him sing until he's finished. And sometimes it can go on for 15 minutes. It's quite intense actually, but really beautiful. Like those songs have been sung in pubs for generations and generations. And it's really those the older generation that still retains that knowledge. And it's really the only in the public house where those things can be experienced, and none of that would be retained in Newfoundland. None of those sort of beautiful historical or cultural things got translated over. It's really just, like I said, about getting as drunk as possible.
Yeah, I mean, as Britain becomes more global, I think that is more the case in Britain as well. Obviously, you'll be seeing a different thing, but I think from the point of view of someone who grew up in Britain, I can see this, that we are losing traditions and thus are adrift in a sense, like almost like people are in the new world. I think people are increasingly deracinated from ancestral traditions and conventions that would keep them sane. And
sort of
it's a strange
rooted
thing.
As well. You know, I feel like it gives you a sense of place in history when you hear those things and when you experience those things. And even just being a bystander or an observer, I think it's really wholesome, and it's a beautiful thing that it is really sad that it's been lost.
Absolutely. And I visited Ireland for the first time a few months ago. And at one point I stayed in an Irish pub for, I think it was about 8 hours, because I was working on the speech for Erkenbrand, and I had to do it. I had to work on it as much as possible that day. And so I stayed there for 8 hours, and it started off like deserted. I was the only person there. And by the time I left, I think it was like 11:30 at night. Mm-hmm. Absolutely full of people, and there were people playing board games, there were people drinking and laughing and singing and so on. And it was just really, I had the sense of a community in a way that I imagine you would have found in Scotland in a Scottish pub 30 years ago, but I have never seen in a Scottish pub for me. You know, I think that Ireland is less globalized, or as we would say in the alt-right, is less paused than, well, certainly than Scotland.
Yeah, but the Irish are very, they tend to be very defensive. Maybe defensive is the wrong word, but protective maybe of their culture, and also very proud of it. Even though it wouldn't be as common to hear a young lad, you know, in his 20s or 30s to be singing Shan O's, if he heard it, he would respect it with the same vigor as someone from the older generation. Which is good, I think.
Of course, of course. I mean, these are the things that will protect people from modern nihilism. And the loss of identity. These are the little things that matter. They seem trivial, and often they seem silly and archaic, but they have a sense of their own. They're valuable simply because they build identity, even if in and of itself the convention tradition doesn't make much sense. That really doesn't matter. This is all about building and maintaining.
Sorry, you cut out there. I didn't identity. Hear the last part.
Oh, I was saying these things matter simply because they help to maintain an identity, which then acts as a bulwark against nihilism.
Absolutely. 100%. I completely agree with that. And even though, you know, the roots of my culture and my ancestry is Irish, it was still a challenge for me to feel like a part of the culture here. You know, there are certain aspects, especially of pub culture, like piss taking, that I really didn't understand. It took me a long time to understand it and to appreciate it for what it was. Because I think in Canadian culture, we all tend to be somewhat uptight, very, very concerned with being polite, and, you know, not stepping on anyone's toes. Whereas in Irish pub culture, piss taking tends to be a way to keep people humble and to not be arrogant. And it's almost kind of like playful sparring in a way. If you're the kind of person who's genuinely going to get upset over some playful piss taking, you're sort of showing your own egotism in doing so. And I really liked that about Irish culture once I understood it. But when I first encountered it, it just seemed like meanness, and it just seemed impolite. And I hated it at first.
I can imagine it would be quite a difficult thing to understand and get used to.
Yeah.
I mean, in Scotland, that would translate to the working class definitely have that, and it's good and bad, because on the one hand it does get rid of ego to an extent, but on the other hand it keeps them down, because they don't even try, because they don't want to be humiliated by, you know, someone else making a barbed comment to them. So it's a double-edged sword, really.
I do agree. And then you've got,
and then among the middle class, it's less of a thing, much less of a thing, really.
Yes.
So let's talk about your process of red pilling. You said it started when you were journeying through Cambodia and India, and that was the poverty that you saw there. How did that because a lot of people would witness that, and that would have the opposite effect. It would make them very globally aware and all humanitarian and that kind of thing. So tell me how that happened.
Well, I think I had some very naive ideas about what backpacking through Southeast Asia was going to be. When I went to Korea, I went to Korea as a Buddhist, and sort of holding Asian culture kind of on a pedestal in a way. And so I felt like I was on this pilgrimage where, you know, I was going to encounter new cultures and new ideas and new types of ways of living, and it would facilitate my enlightenment. It's kind of cringy to say, but that's how I felt. And I also felt, coming from Canada, which, feminism is a really strong aspect of Canadian culture, I feel like among most young women. I felt like, especially when I went to India, that, I felt I'm not going to cover myself from head to toe. I'm a liberated woman, and why should I have to conform to these archaic customs? And when I landed in India, it was just so overwhelming, and I hated it at first. Even just wearing shorts that went to my knees and a regular t-shirt, in certain places, especially in Tamil Nadu province, gangs of men came up to me and were screaming, like literally screaming in my face, and calling to their other friends from outside shops to come over and sort of harass me and point at me for what I'm assuming was what I was wearing and not being covered up enough. And so that was a really traumatic experience, because it was like, I'm not in Kansas anymore, and so I very quickly.
Oh yeah, I can imagine it would have been scary.
It was really, really scary. And even though my boyfriend was there with me, and he protected me and pulled me out of the situation, and we left very quickly from that. But I realized, just because I'm comfortable and used to expressing myself or wearing what kind of clothes I like in my country doesn't mean that I can go wherever I want and be treated the same as I will be in my country. And so I very quickly covered up and purchased clothes that, I never covered my face or my hair, but I was always covered from head to toe for the duration of my time in India. And I hated it. I felt like it was an imposition on me, and I was uncomfortable, and I was hot all the time, and I hated it. And I didn't like that at all. I really didn't. And then also the I don't know how to say it kindly, but the at first the poverty really hurt my heart, and I felt deeply sorry for these people and wanted to help and was very generous, and was consistently putting myself in situations where I was getting taken advantage of, basically.
Oh God, this sounds so awful. It sounds like the sort of middle class Western white girl goes in completely wide eyed. Oh God,
it was horrible. It was horrible. And I was thinking, I don't need to haggle or whatever with these people. I can just give them whatever they want, and they would take and take and take and take it, to the point where I was just like feeling like I had to give more than what I even had myself. I was on a budget myself, but I felt like when I would walk into certain areas of certain towns, it was just like there was a dollar sign on my forehead. And I felt like my compassion and my generosity was taken advantage of on a number of different occasions, to the point where I became indifferent to the poverty, and I became kind of cold and callous and stopped engaging, because I knew that if I engaged and tried to be generous and kind, that I would be taken advantage of. And so I stopped. And that was really, that was hard.
And then you feel bad for that. I mean, this, I can't help think that this just sounds like a situation that should not have come about in the first place. I mean, I understand that people want to travel, and I understand that. But what happened there was that your goodness was turned against you by a foreign group who made you resentful and bitter.
Yes.
You know, it's like, why should a white person be there in the first place to be made bitter and resentful? It would be better for that white person to be in their own country and dealing with the poor there. Because then at least it's a cohesive body of people. You are one of them. They are one of you. And so there isn't that. It isn't possible to become detached, really, or it's much less possible to become detached and bitter, because in the end, you're still dealing with your own people. You can't really turn your back on them. I mean, obviously, it's not black and white. You can become. I know that, but it sounds like it's going to be far more likely to happen when there is a racial divide.
Yes. And now there were certain parts of India that were more westernized, you know, like when I was in Mumbai, and when I was in Goa province and Kerala, it was like, those were the places that it was like, that was the India that I had imagined, you know, but that was because it was like, it was set up for tourism, you know, everything was there to cater to the Western person and make it as luxurious and, you know, lovely as possible. But there was this other side that, you know, the kind of the real India that I hadn't understood or appreciated until I was confronted with. You know, and I am happy that I went. I'm happy that I experienced it. And there were many, many things about being in India that were beautiful, and I'm so happy that I experienced it. But it was very traumatic at the same time.
God, I mean, I've never been to India, but it always just, everyone who's been there tells me something like what you're saying, that yes, there are nice things about it, but it is a mess, and it's such a mess that it actually disturbs you.
Yeah, the thing that actually bothered me the most was the congestion of people, just like how many people were constantly around you all the time, and public transportation always felt unsafe and dangerous. There was this one place called Chennai, I think it was called Chennai, and it was like going into a post-apocalyptic city. Like, there were mounds of garbage everywhere with dogs, wild dogs, like eating out of the garbage, and just it was I couldn't believe that places like that existed, you know. It was really startling. It really was.
Right. So that's very interesting. So how did that? No, I mean, it is, because I can see that it's like this dark experience that triggers a reappraisal of your own values,
yes,
and your own view of the world and people.
Yes.
So how did that manifest? I mean, what did you come away? How were you different when you left? When you ended that experience?
Well, to be honest, I think I really blamed myself more than I blamed India. And I kind of still do. I mean, I went, like you said,
don't.
I felt like I should have been more aware of what I was getting myself into, and that my naive perception of what I was going to be experiencing there as an outsider going in was the real reason why I had such a terrible experience in the beginning. If I had been wiser and if I had done more research about what I was getting myself into, maybe it might not have been so traumatic. But it also made me extremely appreciative and grateful for Canada and the upbringing that I had had. And it made me aware of even in my poverty, in, you know, Newfoundland is not a rich province, and my town was not a rich province, and my family's not a rich family. But even in my comparative poverty to other Canadians, I was still so rich compared to many people around the world. And so it made me extremely, extremely grateful for Canada and my upbringing there.
Mm. Yeah. So let's move forward to, more recent stuff. I want to sort of chart your journey of becoming red-pilled. Mm-hmm. So what was the next thing that happened?
The next thing that happened was the Trump election really was the next big thing that that kind of shook me. As I said, my dad is a Texan. He's a registered Republican voter. He says he's been on the Trump train since the beginning. He's a very boisterous cis white male, proud and loud. And so I got on Skype with him just to catch up one day, and he was wearing the MAGA hat, and I was totally triggered by it. And I was just like, what the hell? Like, are you serious? You actually voting for this guy? He was like, yeah. Like, do you know anything about his politics? And admittedly, I didn't. I had just sort of, I had jumped on the bandwagon of just sort of demonizing him. And at the time I was working in a yoga center that was run by feminists. And so that was the kind of circle that I was in. And that was the mindset I was in as well. So there was no outside percent or no outside opinion really, to be exposed to in that environment. And so because he's my father.
Yeah. Sorry, I just thought yoga versus MAGA. Sorry.
Well, MAGA won.
Sorry.
MAGA won in the end. Because it was my father, I was forced to engage in conversation with a certain level of respect. If it had been anyone else, I probably would have just, done whatever I could to not have to really listen. But because he was my father, I listened and I heard his side of the story, and I was kind of intrigued by it. And his opinions on Trump, and more so his rejection of Hillary Clinton. And I didn't really know much about Hillary Clinton, her career, until my dad had told me about it in that conversation. And so I was intrigued. I was interested. And so I decided, okay, well, maybe I should look into this a little bit. And it's quite funny. At the time, I felt like I was engaging with conservative politics in secret. That's how it felt to me. I felt like I was doing something wrong. Like this was something that was bad that I was doing. And so I started to listen to Dave Rubin, who's, I mean, like, he's not even really that like hardcore conservative, but to me at the time he was. And also like social justice warrior cringe videos started to pop up in my recommended videos, and I started to watch them, and I was just kind of for the first time encountering the madness of the left. And in one of those videos, I saw Jordan Peterson, and he was screaming over a bunch of students, and he was talking about freedom of speech and how, you know, hate speech laws and compelled speech are against the very essence of freedom of speech. And I couldn't wrap my head around how anyone would oppose that. I just was in shock by it. And so I immediately found out who Jordan Peterson was, and went to his channel and started watching his videos. And that opened me up to the fact that conservatives are... They're not hateful, racist bigots. They're people who want to have order in society and security. And there's this sort of emphasis on history and traditionalism and preserving those things. And that's a part of who they are in their personality types and in their expression. And for the first time, I saw that as a legitimate community. That balances out the openness and the creativity of the left. And I saw them both for the first time as two sides of the same coin. And so that was the beginning of it.
I see. So, it's interesting because obviously you, And this is very typical nowadays. You know, people are so immersed in left-wing, liberal, multicultural, that the idea of conservatives having a point has never occurred to them.
Yeah.
Certainly, it's not something that has occupied their minds for any length of time. They just find a way to reject that possibility so as to keep things simple for themselves, which is, you know, understandable.
Yes.
And then something, eventually, you have to be forced to see, well, actually, maybe they do have a point. I think that Jordan Peterson is actually a very good way. I mean, obviously, I made a video quite critical of him.
He's not infallible. He's a human being. I do think that he has made mistakes, and I didn't fully disagree with the points that you made in that video, to be honest. I made a video myself criticizing him not that long ago about the Faith Goldie situation.
Yeah, that was definitely a...
It's a hypocritical. It's quite sad.
Yeah, a lot of people, I think, are disappointed by that. Because it is just embarrassing. It's obviously inconsistent, but I don't want to get too much into... talking about Jordan Peterson,
because obviously
there is a lot to say. I'll just quote the great man himself.
Read Solzhenitsyn. You gotta read Solzhenitsyn, Bucko.
Oh my god! I literally died when I heard that intro. It was so brilliant.
It was a guy called Horatio Carey. He has a channel called Horatio Carey, and he does very funny impressions, and that was his Jordan Peterson.
Absolutely spot on.
Yeah, it's uncanny.
It's the perfect blend of Jordan and Kermit. It's perfect.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I like that Jordan has taken that joke on board, that he sounds like Kermit. Yeah, I know that he's got a picture of it. Yeah, it is hilarious. But anyway, to get back to the point. So it started with the MAGA thing.
With the MAGA thing, yeah.
And that was your father. And then have you gone any further beyond that, or are you at that point?
Yeah, I think I have. The next step was rejecting feminism, which was extremely difficult for me, because like my very best friend in the world back home in Canada, someone who I would consider to be like my sister, is like a woman study major. She's not militant. She's probably one of the more chilled out feminists, if you could believe that. She's very feminine. She accepts gender roles. And she genuinely believes that feminism is supposed to be about allowing women to be whoever it is that they are. Now, I know most feminists aren't like that. But that was sort of what I didn't want to reject feminism, because I did know some feminists that were sound, in my opinion. But the more that I started to explore online, like Dave Cullen's Marxist feminism video, for example, it just blew my mind, really, because there was this whole other side of feminism that I wasn't really taking into account. I had this watered down kind of nice version of feminism, but I wasn't aware of how toxic and aggressive and hypocritical a lot of aspects of feminism had become. And so when I saw that video and I saw the statistics regarding male suicide and debunking the wage gap, also it reminded me of you know, how I had never actually experienced oppression in Canada for being a woman. I had experienced it in other countries, but I had never experienced it in a Western country before. It was like, oh, so actually it's like, it kind of should have stopped at second wave, in my opinion, when I saw that video. All of the third wave aspects of feminism to me began to seem ridiculous. And it was really difficult for me at first to find the bravery to speak about that, especially, you know, showing my face and doing it online, because all of my social network back home are feminists, most of the lads too. And so I felt like it was kind of social suicide. But now I have since... go ahead.
Yeah, well, how has it gone down with them?
Thankfully, because they're Canadians and they don't like confrontation, And they know me, you know, they know me, they know who I am, they know I have a good heart. That just because I decided to reject feminism doesn't mean that I'm against women in any way. And they understood that, thankfully. But now I don't know if that would be the typical response from people who were Canadian, who didn't know me as a person, you know? So if I went back to Canada with these opinions, I would be worried, I think. But amongst my friends, they were understanding. They were like, I'm not going to change my mind about it. And I wasn't really interested in changing their mind, to be honest, but I think they saw my point that I wasn't interested in attacking masculinity. And I always thought that my femininity was under attack by feminists, you know, and that I was always too feminine to be considered a legitimate feminist. And those things became more real to me the more I realized how hypocritical feminism was.
Yeah, this is a realization that quite a lot of people make, that feminism is actually against femininity, and it's basically therefore against women.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, it's trying to make them into something that they are not and that they shouldn't be.
Yeah, yeah. I always hated that about feminism. And I mean, even when I was in Canada, you know, in school I would have taken feminist courses and gender studies courses and all those things, and it seemed like I had to say that I was a feminist, but now I would never have gone to like a women's march. I was never an activist. And I would have never introduced myself or described myself as a feminist. If someone asked me, I would say, yeah, I'm a feminist, but that was because I felt like I had to. I felt like I had no choice. And so when I realized that there were all of these very legitimate criticisms and counterpoints to feminism, it was like this relief. It was like, oh, that uncomfortable feeling inside of me that's always been there with regard to feminism was validated. And so speaking out about it and making my Why I'm Not a Feminist video on YouTube was a great relief for me. It was very cathartic, to be honest.
Yes, I think it often is. When it takes guts to do it, but once it's done,
that's it. It's done.
Yeah. So I suppose that brings us up to the present day. You don't consider yourself part of the alt-right.
No, I don't consider myself to be a part of any political group. I feel like there are parts of me which could be considered liberal and parts of me which could be considered libertarian and parts of me which could be considered conservative. Now, there are some things with regard to the alt-right ideology that I would agree with, even though I wouldn't consider myself to be a part of the alt-right. And that would kind of be the part of the red pill that I feel like I'm currently at and currently trying to negotiate, which is the myth of diversity being a good thing in society. And that's something that I'm still working through. Being from Canada and living in cities which are very multicultural, it's something that I have mixed opinions about, because I understand how mass immigration is it's a threat to the cultures and the nations which are experiencing it, but at the same time, I have lived among second generation immigrants who would have been completely indistinguishable from me in terms of their personalities and their values. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, but I mean, then there's also the genetic thing. I mean, it's not just that mass immigration is a threat to the cultures that experience it, but also to the peoples, because obviously it means that the gene pool is being altered.
Yes. Yeah, I can understand that. And now I feel like I can understand why that would be a concern. But at the same time, I would feel so uncomfortable. Like if two people are in love with each other, I don't know that I would feel comfortable saying that you shouldn't be together just because of your race or because you are different races, if you know what I mean.
Oh, I do know what you mean. I understand, because you do think like, well, why should I ruin this? Why should I insult them? Why should I rain on their parade?
Yeah.
But there are good reasons to rain on their parade, which are that each of them should have a loyalty to their own respective peoples. And you know, their own love for each other is not the be all and end all. I mean, you could even say it's selfish of them to go for that at the expense of ancestral lines that may go back thousands, well, will go back thousands and thousands of years.
So, is it true, though, that most people, like, statistically, most people tend to marry and breed with people who are of their own race just naturally, though? Like, isn't it sort of a small number of people who are in interracial relationships to begin with?
I think it's about 10% now.
So is that something that is, like, really legitimate to be worried about, in your opinion?
Yes, because it's 10%, and also because the propaganda to encourage even more people to do it is relentless. I mean, I was just talking with Mark Collett about the Christmas adverts on TV. It's never ending. It's astonishing now. So there is clearly something going on. Different people have different theories about who and why, who's doing it and why. But there is something going on that will end with the destruction of the white race, whether that's in Ireland or Newfoundland or anywhere else, especially in Canada. I mean, Canada will not be a white country by the end of this century.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't deny that there is, you know, a genetic component to IQ and culture. I've seen the statistics and I've seen the studies and I've heard many people, different people of different perspectives in and outside of the alt-right sort of confirm that for me. But I don't know if it's something like I'm not compelled. I don't feel it within myself to be compelled to tell other people how they should be living their lives.
Yeah, because it's not a nice thing to do. It's not comfortable. But then you've got to think about the young Irish guy singing a song in a pub, and you've got to realise that 20 years hence there won't be the people who will respectfully stop drinking and listen to that, because they will have absolutely no connection to it.
Yes, I mean, I feel like it would be a little bit more of a reasonable solution to allow people to freely associate. And if people who are ethno-nationalists and in the alt-right would like to separate themselves somehow from multicultural cities or societies, I mean, I see no problem with that. But at the same time, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be very resistant to allowing their cities, which are already, and societies which are already multicultural, to be changed, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah, but I mean, what I would say to that is that these cities became multicultural against the will of the people who lived there in the first place. I mean, it's very clear that white people, whether in America or Britain or Germany or anywhere else, have always been against mass immigration because instinctively they knew what it was going to lead to. Even though it seemed preposterous at the time. I mean, you know, if you'd said to Londoners that they were going to lose their city, they wouldn't, 50 years ago, they simply wouldn't have believed that. But still, their instincts were telling them, resist this. And they tried to, and they were ignored. And now they have indeed lost their city. So I think that the change happened against their will. And at this point, the only way that we are going to maintain our existence is by asserting that people should not race mix. And the thing about multicultural cities, what you suggested was that we set up our own mono-racial cities and so on. That would not be allowed in the current paradigm. And second, that would mean retreating to even if it were possible, it would mean retreating to a small part of what were our ancestral lands. See, this is why the alt-right exists. Right? It's not because we want to just make things difficult for people or moan about it for the sake of it. It's because we can literally see that as things currently are, white people are doomed.
Yeah.
It's really that stark.
I know.
And, yeah, it's a horrible thing to face up to, because for a start it's just a horrible prospect, but then you feel guilty for thinking that it's a horrible prospect, because surely you should be okay with that. But instead,
I certainly don't feel guilty about you know, I've looked at like the birth rate numbers, and also like the white population comparatively to other immigrant populations. And you do seem to be right. And I don't feel guilty about kind of worrying about that, personally, but maybe it's just because I'm from Canada and I've lived in cities where it appears to work. It appears to be okay, that I would be more comfortable saying like maybe like a 70-30 split of natives to immigrants, or 80-20. It wouldn't be as important to me for it to be a completely racially pure population. I think as long as the majority are the native population of that country, be it Spanish people in Spain or Swedish people in Sweden, I feel like the culture would still be maintained, no?
Yeah, but that's the thing, though. It doesn't stay at 80-20 or 70-30. You know, London's now, I think it's 55-45. And, well, yeah. Meaning it's 55% immigrant at this stage. So and God knows what Stockholm is like. I mean, you mentioned Sweden. This is a process that goes one way, if left to its own devices. The only way to resist it is to encourage racial identity. And again, that's why the alt-right exists. I mean, I know it's not, as I was saying earlier, I know that it's not nice, because you think, oh God, I'm going to have to advocate something that is, that means encouraging people to do, to not follow their instincts, or, well, it means encouraging people not to race mix, right? And sometimes yeah. People will have the instinct to race mix. So then you're being prescriptive, you know, you're being illiberal and bossy. Well, you know, the trouble is that that's what it means to be in a culture. You know, people are always being bossed around by one force or another. You know, it just is that way. You know, forces gather momentum and start imposing themselves on people, and people are generally okay with that as long as the force in question is the majority. Most people are perfectly happy to go along with the majority.
I hear you on that, but what would you say to, like, so when populations, racial populations or groups of people are isolated genetically, and there's a certain level of inbreeding going on, that can be detrimental to, you know, the offspring of those populations, doesn't it fare? I'm sure you've heard this argument before, but I'm interested to know what you'll say. Like, what would you say about, you know, That seems to imply that two people of different races breeding would be productive because there'd be more biodiversity. Is that not the case?
Yeah, there is the thing about I can never remember the situation with hybrid vigor. I believe that is it's to do with it means that race mixing means that you've got more biodiversity, so that's healthier, and they've got better resistance to diseases and so on. But I believe that is only true in it's true with certain diseases. There is a greater resistance to certain diseases. But as for the inbreeding thing, we're talking about huge populations, like tens of millions of white people in each country. There is no danger of inbreeding. You know, that's something that happens with very small populations. Or with repeated multi-generational cousin marriages. You know, it really is not something that we need to worry about in Europe or the New World. So that's what I would say to that. I mean, there's just no danger of it.
Okay, I suppose that's fair enough.
I don't want to push this, because obviously this is an informal conversation. But I mean, yeah, that's what I would say to it. It's at this stage, I just think, I mean, obviously there are criticisms that can be made of the alt-right, but I think that the sentiment that it expresses is naturally in white people in general. Actually, not just white people. I mean, I've got Muslims and black people contacting me nowadays, saying that they agree with me because they can understand the way things are going and they see why the alt-right exists.
Well, the alt-right,
and they agree with it.
The alt-right tends to, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but there seems to be, like, it's not just about protecting, well, of course, it's a central part of it. It's just protecting the white race. But I've heard many alt-right people in the alt-right that would afford that same luxury to any race, and that
absolutely,
yeah. And so it's not necessarily about superiority or about hating other people. It's just that it's more of an appreciation of diversity, no? And that you want there to be, you know,
yeah.
People yeah, exactly. who have black because, identity and Spanish identity and Swedish identity and white identity and all of those things.
Yeah, because the alternative is that people simply mix together and all of these things are lost. And the more it happens, the more people do mix, the more these things will be lost. And also, let's say only 50% of people race mix. Well, then sort of deconstructs the racial identities of the 50% who don't mix, because you're saying immediately these racial identities that you value are completely disposable. If you could race mix, and it would be absolutely fine. So, I mean, it just makes a joke of the whole idea of identity. So, yes. And that's, to be honest, that's true even with the 10% who race mix today. Even the... Obviously, there are always going to be outliers, but when it's something that's being pushed and recommended and promoted and approved of, that in itself says to the other 90%, your identity does not matter. It's not important. It's not valuable. Do not feel bad if your kids race mix, you know, because it really doesn't matter. So this is the thing. In a sense, it's all or nothing. It ends up, I mean, like all political things, it ends up becoming very stark because it has to in order to go one way or the other. But I think
I do understand the importance of white people being allowed to have their identity being related to their race, if that's what they choose. I mean, the black community are allowed to do it. It seems like everyone's allowed to do it except for white people. And I think that there's something really wrong with that. But I also think, and I think the alt-right should be able to advocate for white identity because they feel that it's important too. And there does seem to be a lot of legitimate reasons for it. But I also don't think that white people should be forced to have racial identity if it's not of interest to them, or if they're indifferent to it, or if they feel like it's not something that really resonates with them.
I think that in the normal run of things, the number of people for whom racial identity would not be important would be very small, like 1-2% of the population, who would be outliers, who would genuinely have a fierce curiosity about the rest of the world. And I think it's very normal and natural. I mean, this is why it's such a difficult thing to get rid of. This is why the propaganda has to be so intense.
See, for me, like when I think about my identity, my race isn't at the forefront of that. I feel like there are so many things that come before my race when I think about who it is that I am and what makes me unique and what makes me special. But what really kind of annoys me and what is when I hear these kind of anti-white narratives in the media and, you know, in critical theory and Marxist academia, that's what kind of brings me to a defensive place where I feel like I need to say my piece in defense of white people, because there does seem to be a certain amount of acceptable racism towards white people. But at the same time, it's when I think about who I am, who Robin is, my race feels secondary. It genuinely does. It doesn't feel like something that's at the forefront of who I am.
Secondary to what other things?
Secondary to my creativity, my ability to articulate ideas, my intellect, my spirituality.
Hold on a second. Your articulacy and that would be an Irish thing, that they have high verbal IQ, so that's genetic.
Right.
Creativity and compassion is definitely a white thing for sure. I mean, you saw that in India. Creativity, again, I think that's very much a European thing. Again, genetic. I'm sorry, but it just seems like all of these things which are unique to you are also unique to the white race, and especially prevalent among whites.
Is compassion specific to the white race, though? I mean, you have like Eastern philosophical traditions like Buddhism and Taoism. And
absolutely.
Even,
absolutely. Any society needs to have some kind of compassion. Otherwise, they would just all kill each other. I mean, obviously, compassion is not unique to the white race. But I think our type of compassion, the compassion that made you go to Cambodia and feel bad for the locals, that's white.
I don't know if I agree. I'll have to look into it a little bit more. I'll have to look into it a little bit more, to be honest.
That's absolutely fine. Okay. Well, let's call it a day there, because I think this has been a really interesting discussion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Excellent. Well, that's Robin from Critical Condition. Was there anything else that... Yeah, is there anything you'd like to add before we end?
No, just thank you so much for having me on. It was a really lovely chat. Hopefully we can do it again in the future. And anybody who is interested in hearing more from me, check out my channel, Critical Condition, or you can follow me on Twitter at CCBucko.
Excellent. Okay. Well... thank you, Critical Condition, and thanks to everyone for listening. Next up is, let's see. Yes, it's Eli Mosley. All right. We'll do that in about an hour from now. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a million, Mose. Cheers. Bye.
Okay. All right.